didn't. We will find more conflict, though, coming up here. Whitney Walton is our next speaker, and she will be speaking about frondeuse and feminists in the work of Arvid Bäring, 1840 to 1908. And Arvid Bäring is the pseudonym of a woman named Louise Cécile Vincennes. Whitney is a professor of history at Purdue University, and in 2005 she was a Fulbright research scholar in Paris, where she did the work that culminated in her book, Internationalism, National Identities, and Study Abroad, France and the United States, 1890 to 1970, published in 2010. Other book publications include Eve's Proud Descendants, Four Women Writers and Republican Politics in 19th Century France, and France at the Crystal Palace, Bourgeois Taste and Artisan Manufacture in the 19th Century. Eve's Proud Descendants was published in 2000, and the France at the Crystal Palace in 1992. She is currently working on the historical writings of Arvid Bäring, and also the naturalist Charles-Alexandre Lesueur, who traveled to Australia and also spent over 20 years in North America. Whitney.
Thank you, Karen. And thanks to Christine and Tracy for organizing this panel. All right. In the late 1890s and until her death in 1908, Arvid Bäring, as Karen said, the pseudonym of Louise Cécile Vincennes, frequently wrote about the distinctiveness of French women in two different but related contexts. The journalistic pieces she wrote for wide circulation publications, including La Revue des Deux Mondes, Le Journal des Débats, and Le Figaro, sometimes criticized feminism and feminist movements, especially in England. Bäring feared that free love and demands for equality between women and men might spread across the channel to France with harmful effects upon what she considered to be the favorable condition of French women and a French tradition, and I'll talk about that more, of women who combined attributes of intelligence and domesticity. At the same time, she wrote a popular and generally well-regarded history of the Duchesse de Montpensier, better known as the Grande Mademoiselle, and other women of the Fronde, that celebrated these figures' challenges to gender norms and their influence over men and in French history. Amidst the disruptions and changes of modernity, including feminism and new women, Bäring sought a model of femininity in Frenchness, I think. In 1894, Bäring prophesied a bad future if women gained equal access with men to education and careers, because there would not be enough jobs for women and they would compete with men. And so she wrote, "Feminists encourage women to have careers, to desert the home for outside activities, clubs, meetings, councils, a public life of various forms. One would say that their ideal is to put the two sexes into a state of antagonism." And then, according to Bäring, this occurred in Germany, where bourgeois men no longer wanted to marry educated bourgeois women. And she writes all these different articles, and that's what I'm referring to. Bäring also feared that divorce, and especially social and legal acceptance of free unions, would deprive women of the protections of marriage. And she cited English literature as promoting this development, specifically Olive Schreiner's Story of an American Farm and Thomas Hardy's Jude the Obscure. Whereas Bäring routinely represented arranged marriage in the 16th and 17th centuries as a misery for women and a limitation on women, she suggested that conditions had greatly improved for women in her own time, notably in France. And she wrote, "The French woman is in one of the best and most favorable positions that exist." In 1901, Bäring wrote that her ideal of femininity was a provincial French housewife, a woman of intelligence with original thoughts who enjoyed maintaining a well-run household and providing good food for her family and friends. and now I'm quoting her, "The French bourgeoise of my youth, who seemed never to leave her salon and who always knew what was happening with her casseroles, seemed to me the ideal of the housewife who was also a woman of the world. Not only was she a much better manager of the house, she was also much more original than her granddaughters, who have degrees, do sports, and are just like all their contemporaries who took the same courses and learned the same exercises." That's the end of the quote. Byron castigated young French women for being overeducated and mere receptacles of the ideas of their professors. She professed admiration for English women who were active in public life and charitable organizations, but she thought that such women should not marry because they could not devote sufficient attention to housekeeping and family. As for her German counterparts, she regarded them as domestic slaves to men. Oh, it's bad. By contrast, and now I'm going to quote her, "Here in France, we are companions and associates of our husbands." Now, Byron definitely favored education for women, but not at the expense of creative thinking and domestic skills. She also acknowledged that women often had to earn a living. And indeed, in 1904, she berated French society for failing to promote as many and varied career options for women as existed in England and Germany. Yeah, talk about contradictions. In her own life and in her biographies and histories, Byron sought ways for women to lead meaningful lives, fulfill their individual potential, and enjoy marriage and motherhood. So that's the stuff about feminism. Now, by the mid-1890s, when Byron started publishing articles that challenged or disparaged feminism, she was a popular and respected author of biographies, reviews of foreign literature, and articles on a range of historical and current events topics. I can't tell you how popular she was. I mean, everybody read her. Her subjects included Elizabeth Patterson, the American wife of Jerome Bonaparte, Emily Rothe, born Saida Salome, princess of Zanzibar and Oman, who married a German merchant, Queen Christina of Sweden, Jacques-Henri Bernardin de Saint-Pierre, the philosopher Salomon Maimon, Jane Welsh Carlyle, Mary Wollstonecraft, Saint Teresa of Avila, Alfred de Musset, and many, many others. In 1899, she published in serial form what became her best-known and certainly her longest work, the first part of a two-volume biography of the Duchesse de Montpensier, La Grande Mademoiselle. As with all her biographical studies, Byron analyzed Montpensier on three levels. And this, I finally figured out, this is how she approached all of her subjects. Inherited traits, social and cultural influences or challenges to them, and personal choices. The work is also one of French singularity that complements or complicates Byron's anti-feminism. Byron explains her choice of subject as representative of a significant moment in French history, the change in French mindset from emphasizing glory to that of love that accompanied the establishment of absolute monarchy. Byron asserts that Montpensier embodied this transformation of sentiment in her life, and I quote, "Mademoiselle illuminates her environment." She also wrote that Montpensier's memoirs offered a girl's perspective on the court of Louis XIII, a perspective to which men historians have not accustomed readers. Byron presents Montpensier as a woman of action who controlled her own destiny within the constraints of her time. Montpensier thirsted for glory above love, and this meant marrying into power. She already was the wealthiest woman in France from her birth. She was the pursuer rather than the pursued, and for a time she aspired to marry Louis XIV, who was 11 years her junior, for her own ends. According to Byron, and now I'm quoting her, "It was not her fault if nature, making her a woman, gave her a bearing, an inclination, a little too masculine." And you can see she has, you know, that, you know, late 19th century, you know, hereditary science going on here. In La Jeunesse de la Grande Mademoiselle, Byron presents elite women as major players in the time of Louis XIII and Louis XIV, both culturally in their invention of salons and politically. She contrasts the political involvement of 17th century French women associated with noble privilege to feminist rights claims of Byron's own time. And she writes, "Elite women were all powerful in politics. as it is doubtful they could ever become again under the most feminist code, because rights inscribed in the law are nothing compared to the privileges conferred by custom. So that's in her book. Barine quotes Cardinal Mazarin on the capability of rule, for rule of three noble women in the 17th century. She quotes him, "We have three..." she wrote, "We have three women who would be capable of governing or overthrowing three great kingdoms, the Duchesse de Longueville, the Princesse Palatine, and the Duchesse de Chevreuse." Barine then detailed the abilities, achievements, and escapades of the three women, including their common practice of donning men's clothes and their involvement in the Fronde, without diminishing their femininity. She writes, "Never were women more women." According to Barine, the power of elite women peaked with the Fronde. Montpensier, in particular, achieved her moment of glory in 1652 when her father declined to lead a force to the town of Orléans, which was part of his domain. And Montpensier, assisted by Mesdames de Fiesque et de Frontenac, commanded the opposition troops from Paris to Orléans. She won the cheers of the people of Orléans for her speech that she would rescue Louis XIV from the foreigner Mazarin. After a few weeks, Montpensier made her way back to Paris to join forces with another Frondeur, the Prince de Condé. Their control of Paris was brief, and to end the unrest, Parisians welcomed the return of Louis XIV on October 21, 1652. Now, Barine asserts that Montpensier failed to understand the transformation in French history that followed the Fronde. The rebellion ended aristocratic grandeur, and, contrary to what Barine calls French tradition, ushered in royal absolutism and bourgeois influence. Barine writes, "It is not I who criticize Mademoiselle. It is to her credit that she was not flexible in the age of servility that succeeded the Fronde." So, Barine represented Montpensier as both pathetic and admirable. She got what she deserved, exile for 5 years at one of her estates, and Karen sent me a picture of it, by participating in a failed revolt that greatly damaged France. Yet, she did so out of a sense of proud, even heroic entitlement that she retained to the end of her life, in contrast to less heroic men of the Fronde. And she wrote, "The Grande Mademoiselle was always the Grande Mademoiselle. And if this was sometimes her weakness, it was also, more often, her claim to glory." Barine's judgment of Montpensier, similar to that of her subjects in some of her other writings, Portrait de Femme and Princesse et Grande Dame, was sometimes harsh. But the women in all of her writings come across as vibrant, intelligent, and passionate individuals. Unlike the portrayals by Charles-Augustin Sainte-Beuve in his book, also titled Portrait de Femme, published in 1844. In the earlier work, Sainte-Beuve presented a wide array of French women writers, mostly from the 18th century, as tasteful, refined, and rather static, to whom he paid homage. By contrast, Barine chose more diverse subjects, women who lived exciting lives and made hard choices, and she did not spare them admiration or condemnation. It is perhaps not surprising, then, that readers in her own time had difficulty determining Barine's feminist or anti-feminist leanings, which the extensive correspondence to Arvède Barine held in the Department of Manuscripts at the French National Library reveals. One correspondent, Pastor Edouard Dufour, wrote in 1901, "I do not know if you are a feminist or to what degree." And then also in 1901, requesting from Barine another version of her work on Montpensier, intended for a broader audience than the readers of the Revue des Deux Mondes, publisher René Dumic proposed a series on heroic women with feminist implications that would include the Frondeuses. And he wrote to her, "You would then have a collection giving an impression of women as extraordinary, chivalrous, adventurous, riding in parade, battling, and finally securing a foothold on territory generally reserved for men." So there's you know, people, yeah, she's a feminist, yeah. By contrast, L.M. Monin, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce his name, he praised Barine's critique of feminism in her article on Ideas from a Housewife in 1901, and he writes, "You are right, too many blue stockings, not enough women wanting to be women, that is, wives and mothers, to spread the happiness of the earth." Another, fan mail writer, she got lots of letters from her readers, wrote, "There are undoubtedly two feminisms, and maybe more than two, It seems that the one I wish to prevail with the goal of improving marriage would win your approval. Now, finally, I have to read this one. Okay, Jeanne E. Schmal, an activist for married women's earnings rights and eventually for women's suffrage, probably characterized Barine's position well in a letter to Barine of April 20th, 1895. And this is Jeanne Schmal. I think I read between the lines of your articles on feminism that you are not opposed to certain well-considered reforms, but that you are only an adversary of crazy ideas of these wild women, in English, who damage reasonable and moderate elements of the feminist movement. More recently, two feminist scholars in France interpret Arvède Barine very differently. In her dissertation of 2012, Sophie Vergne includes Barine among other 19th century historians who, she claims, misread the memoirs of the Fronde and moralized against the Frondeuse for being unpatriotic and self-centered, if not frivolous. Vergne quotes Barine dismissing the women of the Fronde. One is horrified by these false heroines, these ungenerous women with perverted imaginations. And it's true, she wrote that. By contrast, Isabelle Ernaux emphasizes the gender reversals in Barine's history as a challenge to conventional masculine authority and feminine subordination. This was particularly evident in Barine's portrayals of Montpensier and her father, the brother of Louis XIII, Gaston d'Orléans. He is a coward. She is brave. He has no political backbone. Orléans betrayed his accomplices, and he was submissive. By contrast, according to Barine, Montpensier had a chivalrous soul, and she never lied or betrayed anyone. She was always valiant and generous. Additionally, Ernaux quotes Barine and women of the 17th century criticizing and rejecting arranged marriages as a proto-feminist manifestation. In this history and in her other writings, Arvède Barine defied easy categorization regarding women and especially feminism. Barine's histories of women reflect her ambiguous relationship to feminism. She was selective in her approval of reforms to improve women's education and their economic condition, and she condemned what she considered unreasonable or harmful claims, including challenges to the institution of marriage. She was not a new woman in terms of publicly performing new feminine identities, for Barine as a person eschewed the limelight and proudly proclaimed that she was a housekeeper. Yet, the women, and especially the French women in her histories, performed extravagantly and powerfully in public spaces. While Barine herself did not play with gender roles in the sense that she conducted herself as a good bourgeois wife, she chose to study women in the past who violated norms, exerted influence, if not power, and practiced masculine behaviors without undermining their femininity. The French cultural tradition she drew upon was less aesthetic and seductive than aristocratic and intellectual. It may not be coincidental that Barine wrote the history of the original 17th century Frondeuse at the same time that Marguerite Durand's newspaper, La Fronde, fostered new careers and public activities for women. Mary Louise Roberts analyzes Durand as performing French feminism through her beauty and theatricality, as well as through the newspaper. In a different way, notably in the history of the Frondeuse, Barine celebrated the Frenchness of influential aristocratic women who reconfigured gender norms while retaining their femininity. She transposed this into her own time, constructing a modern model for women that combined companionate marriage and capable domesticity with opportunities in education and careers. Thank you.
Thank you, Whitney. We don't have a formal commentator today, and I'm going to propose two options to the panelists. One is that you might want to consider having a little conversation among yourselves, and then we open it up to the audience for comment, or we can simply open it up. What is your preference?
I'm fine with opening it up.
Yeah, I'll just open it up.
Open it up? Okay. Maybe we could... Yes, come over. So, we will open it up then to the audience for comments. Maybe some of you in the back would come down to the front so we can have a more intimate group. Thank you. And let us see who wants to put her hand up, his or her hand up first. Who has a question or a comment? Sarah.
I'm Sarah Kimball at DePaul University. I have two questions, I think, and it's a way to sort of get the panel thinking about the comparisons. I wondered two things. One is whether you see a hierarchy of nations when there are comparisons between France and the United States and England, or where those comparisons are functioning in French singularity, mm-hmm. Whether nation or race or however that category is functioning, and whether the second question is about the change in French singularity over time. Mm. I mean, we have a significant time span here, and I wondered between your papers or among your papers, you see a change over time or stasis.
All right. Who wants to begin?
Who wants to go first?
Go ahead.
I'll give it a whirl.
Sure.
If you want. Tocqueville, obviously a comparativist. Who traveled to the United States, to Canada, and to England. He did think it was significant that American settlers came from England a lot of the time I think de Tocqueville's democracy in America is really democracy in New England, or perhaps democracy in Boston. And you start to wonder how many exceptions you can have to your generalizations before they just completely collapse. But he certainly, when he goes to Canada, he's very struck by the difference between British Canada and French Canada. And he's very interested in French Canada because to him it reminds him of pre-revolutionary French France, as he understands it to be. And England, for him, I would say he doesn't really rank as if they were three different countries. He more thinks about British North America and French North America compared to each other and related to their British and French origins. And he does have, every so often there will be a sort of three-way comparative aside, my favorite one being that if you wanted to support a worthy cause in France, you would turn to the central government. In England, you would find an aristocratic patron. And in the United States, you would start a grassroots organization. But most of the time, he doesn't do those kinds of three-way comparisons. And that's obviously not a hierarchical comparison. It's about difference. When it's two-way comparisons, it's always France and the United States. And I guess in terms of the change over time, I was thinking about this when I was reading the papers and mm-hmm. also when I was listening to the papers. It seems to me that Tocqueville, his idea of the Gallic singularity has nothing to do with royal mistresses' ability to affect politics. It has nothing to do with courtly love. It does have to do with married women's presence in public as sociable creatures and the potential for adultery that comes with that. It has to do with arranged marriages, which he sees as a terrible thing about the French system, which he thinks makes young French women passionate novel readers who get crazy ideas about what the world would be like and run away with unsuitable people and have to be dragged home by their parents. You know, it really matters to him that young American women can go out with anyone they want and they pick exactly the people that the family accountant would pick. It's like, yeah, this is right. So I think there is a real change in what the Gallic singularity means, but at the same time, at the heart of it, there is this idea that there's a special, somewhat sexual relationship between men and women. In his case, he calls it flirtatiousness. And I will say that it seems to me that he also flirted his way up and down the East Coast himself. Yes.
And that's what feminists mean today. Modern feminists, they mean that special relationship. And it's definitely meant to be derogatory when Mona Ozouf, for example, gets into a fight
for
with Stonewall.
Sure.
So, yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that they mean that to be superior to our Anglo sort of, I don't know, pallid and banal, boring,
contentious. Yeah. Yes, and there's no doubt that I disagree with her about that either.
Yeah. And I think as far as the change goes, I mean, I don't think that there, in fact, is any similarity really between the way men and women interacted in the 12th century and the way they do in the 21st century. But I think that they do, I mean, if you, I don't know, say Marc Fumeroli, people talking about conversation and the special freshness of that, they are pointing back to that whole tradition, even though in a literal sense, I don't think there is any particular continuity.
Yeah, I mean, the sort of traditional breaking point, of course, would be the French Revolution, mm-hmm. right? When, you know, the tradition of the salon doesn't entirely go away, but it takes a very different form in the 19th century that I mean, Ozouf quotes conversations about this, that you know, the salon seems to have disappeared. It seems to me that starts to crack open earlier than that in the 18th century, that there is something changing, not the tradition of conversation in the salons, which continues, but sort of the discomfort about that. Or I mean, it does seem to me, I'm focused on royal mistresses, so I'm seeing something very particular. And if we widen the lens, I mean, perhaps the timeline is different for women more generally. And so it does seem to me that the idea exists over a very long time. The specificities of it are different mm-hmm. in different mm-hmm. historical contexts. So,
yeah, that's what I would say. Because I think there's what I like about this panel is that continuity of Frenchness, but I think it assumes different forms right. at different times, and certainly in the hands of different interpreters.
Anybody else?
Sydney Watts, University of Richmond. I was struck by this, all the papers in so many ways, but I was curious if you could comment on the idea of the Gallic singularity as a norm, and then how it's situated, as you were saying earlier, Whitney, in the particular, and in the sense of how these papers hang together. To me, it seems as if there are these attempts of commentators to want to see norms, and then others who really are trying very hard to negotiate the interaction that happens at a particular moment between Guinevere, you know, opening the grate and saying, come in, you know, or the moment of being flirtatious. I mean, I wonder if that isn't a tension, in particular with Tocqueville. He's trying to create so many norms, but at the same time, he has to deal with his experience and what he actually encountered, perhaps that made him, you know, think about it a little bit differently. So I'm wondering if, and maybe it's really coming out of you know, the idea of how to make sense of this letter to his sister and what he writes, you know, 5 or 10 years later.
Well, I guess in terms of the letter to his sister, it's one of several letters that he writes to his sister in which he makes the same point in different ways. And he also writes a letter to a male friend of his, in which he makes the point in yet another set of ways. And I think honestly, sometimes his relatives at home were a little worried that he was going to stay in the United States and never come back, and he wants to reassure them that he is, in fact, coming home. Although then he shocks them when he marries, you know, he comes from an old aristocratic family, and he marries a British commoner. So they were, that was not what they had in mind when they wanted him to come home and get married. That was not their plan. And I guess as far as norms as opposed to individual experiences, I don't know, because he asked the people that he wrote to, he and Gustave de Beaumont both, when they wrote their letters, they asked their letter recipients to keep them, so that they could use them as notes for their book when they got back. And they're often strikingly similar, in fact. There are certain letters that you can really read as little mini digests of what is going to be in Democracy in America. So this reversal is unusual, actually, if you compare the correspondence and the book more generally, or if you compare the interviews and the book more generally, they're usually much more continuous. I guess people famously say that in Democracy in America itself, the first volume is about the stories and the second volume is about the norms. And the chapters on women are in the second volume, which is the norm volume. But I don't know. The thing I wonder about the most myself is how typical he was when he was claiming to have this new view, how typical he was of the 1830s. And especially for me, striking, because I'm usually a late 19th century historian, when people see all these things about American women and they just think that's awful. Those girls, they're independent. They walk out. They read. They're interested in things. That's feminism. That's scandalous. That's shocking. They shouldn't do that. Yet he seems to think they should, at least sometimes.
I really enjoyed all your papers. My name's Maura Cross. I work on Florent Tristan mostly, but history of feminism. What strikes me is the not so much the Gallic singularity and expressions of it or examples of it, but how this is a myth and how the myth is perpetuated. Mm-hmm. Have you looked at the way, for instance, the history of queens or history of women in France is portrayed in primary school textbooks, or how is this conveyed after the Ancien Régime into the 19th century, sort of the role of the stereotypical role of the dangerous women in politics or whatever, and in terms of Tocqueville, are there reactions to what he's sort of all his generalizations, because it's generalizations about in print, are there immediate reactions writing to him, and does he find the same thing when he visits Ireland? The aristocracy, he condemns the British aristocracy very strongly for its landlord system. Does he mention women?
I think that part of what, I mean, I haven't looked at textbooks on this so much, but if you look at the historiography of the 19th and 20th century, the things that mistresses are critiqued for or praised for sort of sets out norms, sets out a way of thinking about this and perpetuates this myth, right? Because the things that people choose to focus on, that these male historians, and one of the really interesting things in looking at these women is not just the reality of their lives as much as we can discern that, but what people have subsequently had to say about them, how they have portrayed them, and what they choose to criticize in Madame de Pompadour versus what they choose to praise in her, what they choose to praise in a Maintenon or degrade her for, that says something about those norms as they're being created and the myth of the French woman that they wish to present. And so that's what I found interesting, were these sort of contrasting images of that appear over time in a sense. And so,
anyone else?
Sure. Let me think for a second about this. All right. First of all, in terms of correspondence, of course, and response. The response I would most like to know is Emily Delisle de Tocqueville's response, what she was writing back to her brother. I don't know if those letters exist. If they do, I haven't found them yet, but this is the very early stage of a project, so there's time to look. And similarly, in terms of an early stage, I haven't followed Tocqueville to Ireland yet, so I can't tell you what he thought about that, aside from, yes, knowing that he was very critical of the landlord system. In terms of other reviews, John Stuart Mill gave the book a good review, but I don't remember him saying anything particular about Tocqueville's views of women, which is sort of odd when you think about what we usually think of John Stuart Mill talking about. Although I do think, having read a lot of John Stuart Mill for other reasons, that they do share this what Alan Gahan calls aristocratic liberalism, that, they like democracy, but they like a certain version of democracy in which the smartest people are in charge of it. And they worry very much about what would happen if that ever were not to be the case. And indeed, it was there during Jackson's democracy. So he sees a lot of that. And his favorite informants are the Boston Whigs, who, of course, are all passionately anti-Jackson. So in terms of women's responses, I guess the one I know the best is Catherine Beecher's. And she's a late 19th century reformer who, depending on who you read, no one ever thinks she's a feminist. Some people think she's an anti-feminist. But I guess I would say, like Arvid Barin, she thought there was more scope for women than they had, and she wanted to push at the boundaries, and she was a proponent of women's education. And so she saw Tocqueville's view of American women as the guardians of American mores and the foundation of a healthy democracy. That was exactly what she wanted to say to everybody as well. You know, look, you don't need to be involved in politics. You would, in fact, lose all your influence if you went into politics. But what you have is this very important role, and here's this very important person who already said so. So you get the whole range, I think. Those are a great set of questions, by the way. A whole research program right there.
Rebecca?
Rebecca Rogers, and I'm sorry I missed the first two papers. Just sort of listening and thinking about the other questions that have been made, you know, when I came late to this panel, I was thinking of Mona Ozouf, and so... I'm not sure I can articulate the question I have, but it does come into sort of this myth of, you know, taking seriously the idea that it's a myth, but then also the ways in which historians have, used this myth in relationship to feminism. I mean, because I read Mona Ozouf as, you know, this is one of the reasons why we don't need feminism in a way, because we've managed to pacify the relationship between the sexes. And so, I mean, maybe it's more, you know, Whitney's thinking about somebody who's trying to write history and how does, I mean, so I'm not sure I have a real question, but it is sort of what does this myth open in terms of ways of thinking about feminism, the writing of feminism, and changing women's status in society.
Well, I guess if I could take advantage of this question from Rebecca, to as at least at this point, my thinking about Arvid Barin is that I think she was struggling with feminism in her own time, and I think that the history, and to some extent the French singularity as she defined it, was a way to deal with her discomfort with some of the feminist things. But I also, you know, in terms of the myth, see, I think she was making it up as she went along. And also, what finally, you know, I'm sitting here reading all these contradictions, and I think what I said about the way she approached her subjects, because she wrote, in addition to this long history that was the main part of my presentation, she wrote all these biographies of a wide range of people. And she had these three levels of analysis. So, you know, she's really into, you know, that late 19th century hereditary, like especially hereditary disabilities and addictions. And, you know, she wrote this book on substance abusers. I mean, she's really interested in this. But I think that's one level of her analysis, and this comes out a lot. That one brief quote about Montpensier, it's not her fault if nature made her like a man. So she can excuse a lot because nature does stuff, and you know people don't have any control over that. And then at another level, she's very interested in, and she writes a lot about social and cultural contexts. And most of her praise for women in the past comes from their defiance of social and cultural norms. Saint Teresa of Avila, she wouldn't get into an arranged marriage. She wasn't suited for marriage. She said, I couldn't do what I want if I were married. And this comes up in many of Barin's subjects. So challenging cultural and social norms is a good thing because women can do things that way. But then you get to personal choices, the third level. And boy, this is when it's slash and burn. I mean, you know, if you make a bad choice, that's your problem, you know. And she doesn't have a lot of sympathy for bad choices. I mean, a little bit she does, but much less. Anyway, so these three levels of analysis helped me, I think, to figure out a little bit of why she could make like the statement that Vernier quoted about, oh, these are horrible frondeurs. And yet there are many positive statements about the frondeurs and Montpensier. But I think it's if you look at it at these different levels, then you can sort of figure it out.
Yeah, I wanted to pick up, you used that word natural, and I think that's a continuity that perhaps means it's so obvious,
yes,
none of us
yeah,
have
right.
mentioned, but clearly
yes.
no matter what century we're in, and no matter which speakers we're talking about, no matter what they're discussing, they mm-hmm. think that the relationship between men and women is natural in a way that, for example, for Tocqueville did not think the relationship between fathers and sons was natural. He thought that changed over time and became less patriarchal in ways that he heartily approved as a way of revolution. He did not think the relationship between the races or between masters and slaves was natural. He did not think that the relationship between indigenous peoples and Anglo settlers was natural. He did not think, you know, Irish landlords and their peasants, who some observers would have said were like a different race, he did not think that was natural. But by golly, he thinks the relationship between men and women, whatever it is natural, even as he's describing two comparative systems which organize it completely differently. And this goes back to the examples and the norms as well, I think, is that in most of the things he talks about, his examples and his generalizations support each other well and fully. But when he talks about women, it's not just the difference between the letter and the book, but the examples he gives. He says women have all this influence. Never does he show an example of a woman exerting influence. He says women are exhausted. He does have an example of women being exhausted. He seems to think that's because they have repressed flirtation. I think it's because they have 8 children and a husband who doesn't give them any help. But, you know, but the point is he thinks that's natural, unlike all the other things he sees that he does not think are natural. And I think that idea that this is natural, that seems to be a huge continuity through the centuries.
Well, and the emphasis on unnatural effaces the need for feminism, right? Because if these relations are natural, they persist and they're okay, you know, because it's natural. That therefore there's no impetus for change. It might sort of take on specifics in different historical time periods, but it is dictated by nature. And I mean, that seems to be Osuf's, you know, sort of the underlying argument as well. In the case of France, we let these natural relations play out, and therefore we don't really need feminism as such, you know, because someday.
Or feminist scholarship.
Or feminist scholarship, yeah.
And I think that's an important point.
Right. Yeah. So.
Any other questions? I think I'm going to ask a question then. And to Whitney, I would say, do you think that the age that Arvid Barine is when she's writing these mm-hmm. biographies has something to do with it? I notice she's mm-hmm. born in 1840.
Yes.
That makes her in 1900 60 years old.
That's right.
Which is old by the yes. standards of the time.
Yes.
Do you think she was reacting to these women's dilemmas differently at that point than she was, say, maybe 10, 15 years earlier?
Wow. I don't know. I mean, her life story, you know, she came to writing late, so the stuff that I've looked at really comes from quite late. I really don't know. And I don't know the answer to that, but let me just throw out one tidbit that I found really interesting. She did participate in the first Prix Féminin. So, you know, she was part of the committee to award a prize juried by all women. Because some of her fellow authors at the time were frustrated that only men would get these prizes. And so it's interesting, and there's been a little bit of work on this, that when this group got together, and they were all women, and they deliberately said, you know, we are all women, and we're gonna judge what's the best book this year. And they occasionally chose male authors, but the point was that it was women making this decision. So I don't know the answer to that good question.
Something to think on.
Right. Definitely.
We could go on, I'm sure, but it looks like we are close to closing time, and there are other things happening at 6. So thank you all very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you to the panelists. And we'll all go out thinking more about the French singularity. Gallic singularity.
Gee, I just have